You're listening to the Nerd News Network. When news breaks, we bring you the pieces. From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 143 of Little Brother for the 10th of February, 2024. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. A Nightscope K5 robot that has been patrolling the Times Square 42nd Street subway station in New York City has been retired from service. It had been deployed for 7 months on a trial run. During its run, it patrolled the station overnight, accompanied by a couple of uniformed officers. Critics claim that the robot was merely a gimmick and that in its absence, the uniformed officers would have sufficed. Records show that the pilot project cost the city approximately $12,500 and that the operational costs of such robots is in the $60,000 to $70,000 range. According to the city's website, the starting salary for a uniformed officer is $58,580 a year. It has long been suspected or generally understood or something like that, that law enforcement agencies of various types and levels have been skirting the requirements of the Fourth Amendment by turning to data brokers and simply buying the data that they otherwise might need a warrant to acquire. Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon, has been asking questions around the topic and managed to extract from the National Security Agency, the NSA, an admission that they have been doing this. The agency claims in its response that it takes steps to minimize the collection of U.S. persons. That's right, they're bypassing the law, but only a little bit. Mikkel Dencker, a graduate student at the Technical University of Denmark, was concerned about how there seems to be no truly open way to browse the internet. Google, of course, tracks you relentlessly so that it can populate your web browsing experience with advertisements tailored to your search terms. More privacy-oriented engines, such as DuckDuckGo, Search, and StartPage, don't necessarily do that, but also don't open their code for examination. Denker's response has been to create a new search engine, dubbed Stract, which offers a high level of customization, no tracking, and complete transparency, including publication of the engine's source code on GitHub. The search engine is currently in beta. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned Recently? Today's winner is Mercedes-Benz. Security researcher Shubham Mittal discovered a set of working credentials in a GitHub repository published by the German automaker and reached out to technology publication TechCrunch for assistance in reaching them about it responsibly. The credentials should provide completely unfettered access to several Mercedes data stores in Azure and AWS. Mercedes have declined to state whether or not any data has been exfiltrated by third parties. An interesting thing happened at the Almany 2600 meeting this month. Two of the attendees, Phil and Ed, decided to flip the script and interview me. Here's how that went. So maybe there's a few of you who listened to the show back in 2000 to 2002 when it was an actual broadcast radio program instead of a podcast. May remember Phil. Say hi, Phil.
Hello.
And Phil has decided tonight that he's going to flip the script on me, and he's going to ask me a few questions. What do we have?
All right, well, we're here at the 2600 meeting, and we took some collective questions from the people here. First question I'd like to ask is, object-oriented versus functional programming, what's your take on it, and which do you prefer?
I personally am a big fan of object-oriented programming, but I don't actually mind functional. I do have Lisp in my stable of languages that I can code in, but the thing is, I don't actually do that very often. More often I write things in Python, and everything in Python is obviously object-oriented because everything is an object. I feel like the use of object orientation to keep your functions right handy and to be able to quickly take a existing design, copy it, and modify it is an extremely powerful thing that functional programming lacks.
Okay, very good. What is your opinion of IoT connected appliances, and do you trust the security the manufacturers implement on them? Do you feel comfortable using them in your home? Why or why not?
Oh, fuck no. Oh, fuck no.
I see this is not a family-friendly program.
Oh, no, it never was. Not since episode 45. But it absolutely is not something that I want to deal with in my home. The only appliance that I've got that has even got the ability to function as an IoT device is my washing machine. And we have not put it on the internet, and we have done so deliberately. We've not put it on the Wi-Fi. It does not have any idea how to get there.
There you go. You don't want people hacking your laundry.
Oh, no, no, no. But the biggest problem, really, with IoT devices is that I expect an appliance that I've purchased to last way longer than I think your typical IT project does. I expect that I'm going to be able to continue to use the thing for, you know, maybe a decade to a decade and a half. And that's long enough that when you get to a service that it relies upon, the service might actually become deprecated and then it becomes unusable. Worse yet, the updates to the software will stop coming. And as a result, any vulnerabilities that might appear in the piece of hardware don't get patched.
Well, it's kind of like planned obsolescence. They want you to buy a new one every so often.
Well, of course they do. But the fact of the matter is that I've got devices in my home that are 15 years old that were never meant to be still used at 15 years old. You've seen my laptop computer. It's a 2009 Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah, mine's about just as old.
So, and I keep it running. And I keep it running thanks to Linux.
Yep. All right, so what about sequential versus gate arrays?
Clarify the question a bit.
I don't know if I can. Hold on, I'll pass the mic.
Let's put it to Ed.
My thought on the question was, What do you think is better, sequential programming or using gate arrays?
Okay, so sequential programming, you're talking about traditionally using things like Python or Lisp or assembly
yes.
code or what have you,
yes.
versus implementing things in gate arrays. They both have their place, and it really largely depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. Phil asked the question about functional versus object orientation, for instance.
Yes.
There are cases where I would want to go with a functional programming language simply because of the fact that a problem that I'm dealing with is most easily solved recursively, and functional programming languages absolutely shine at that sort of a solution. Then there are other problems that are better solved through a sequential technique, and then there are some that are better solved by things being considered in a simultaneous context.
Mm-hmm.
To that end, I am an automation engineer, and I do sometimes deal with PLCs.
Yes.
And PLCs are basically a digital implementation of what would be otherwise a set of relays functioning in a fashion similar to how a logic gate would do.
Yes.
So even though this is software that's programmed into a device, it still behaves like a gate. So really the answer is that it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Depends on the application. I mean, one of the things that, in my opinion, gets me slightly annoyed is that when somebody's trying to do something very simple, but they need to have a Raspberry Pi and an Arduino in order to flash a light, you know.
Well, you know, the Raspberry Pi and the Arduino are for blog cred.
Gotcha. All right, back to Phil.
Okay, right. I think this is a good one to finish up with.
Okay.
Looking back on technology from 20 years ago compared to technology now, predict how society will implement technology 20 years down the road, and what will that world look like?
Okay.
IoT devices.
I think that the first thing that we're going to see has to do with the storage, and we're already starting to see this transition from magnetic storage to flash storage. As it is right now, you will find in corporate data centers some very large NASs that are composed entirely of very fast flash storage, where only 7 years ago, those would have been composed probably of 15,000 RPM SAS drives. Now, this is not to say that the 15,000 RPM SAS drives aren't still out there. This is not to say that magnetic storage does not still have its place. My personal server has 25 terabytes of magnetic storage in it and 1 terabyte of SSD. Why? Because my pockets are only so deep.
Right.
But
yeah.
I think that what's going to happen, I've watched as the comparative prices of magnetic storage versus SSD have gradually converged. They've gone from 6 times the price per terabyte for SSD to now it's closer to 4 times the price. And I think in the next 3 to 6 years, we're going to reach the point where maybe we haven't achieved price parity between the two, but where the prices become close enough that it's not important and we'll be able to use flash for everything. So that's going to cause a knock-on effect of massively improving the performance of our devices.
Mm-hmm.
So things will run faster just as a result of the storage being faster. RAM will become cheaper. Right now, the largest machine I personally own has got 64 gigabytes of RAM in it, and that is a rare weirdness
for it
to have that much RAM.
Yeah, because even new computers now, typically they're selling, you know, go to Staples, it's like 8, you know.
8 to 16,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And the reason this has got 64 is because of the fact that it's a VM host.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't imagine that individuals are going to be doing a lot of VM work, but I think it's become very quickly a very important feature of the corporate data center. So single servers with massive amounts of memory are not that weird. And for hackers and experimenters like you and I, it makes sense to have machines with these large memory loads for the purpose of being able to do things in multiple VMs. Processors are going to evolve. They will get faster. How much faster? I don't know. I kind of feel like we've hit a plateau, not because the processors can't get faster, but because for a large part we don't need them to be faster. Mm-hmm. You know, for the vast majority of the things that the vast majority of people do most of the time, with the possible major exception of video gaming, 2 gigahertz is actually still a pretty snappy machine.
Or crypto mining.
Well, yes. I mean, crypto mining, you're going to have to go to ASICs for that. There's just no getting around that fact. I mean, for a large part, even going on a GPU is no longer viable. But I think that the expansion of AI technologies is going to come to a point where it might start to become feasible to run an AI on our own individual computers. I think that we're not going to necessarily be able to train them ourselves, but we should be able to, either as a subscription service or preferably by a free and open source model, be able to download a fully trained model that we can load into our computer and run pretty easily. Mm-hmm. We're going to have that kind of computational horsepower at our disposal as individuals, assuming that we don't completely forego the PC in favor of the phone, in which case everything's going to go to the cloud.
Right. All right, well, thank you very much. It was fun.
Hey, thank you. I agree. This was a good thing. We should do this again sometime.
Yeah, definitely.
So that happened. As usual, I also passed the mic and got some opinions. Before the meeting, Tim the Enchanter had shared an anecdote about a police detective who had allegedly expressed the idea that a cell phone being turned off is sus. The wording, as I got it, was, "If your phone is off, you are either missing or wanted." I asked the various attendees for their views on this topic.
I don't agree with it. I think that, you know, a lot of people nowadays don't have privacy. Mm-hmm. And there's really no expectation of privacy anywhere you go now. You're out in public and you're on camera. You carry your phone with you. I mean, it's got GPS. They know where you are if anyone wants to find you. I have no problem just leaving my phone at home for like a day or two and just go out camping or something, not even worry about technology or privacy for a bit. It's kind of refreshing.
What? I turn mine off when I don't need an alarm. Like, I'd prefer to turn it off every night.
Okay.
If I didn't have to wake up to an alarm every morning.
I guess what bothers me is about it is the fact that somebody from law enforcement is saying this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the phone equivalent to the idea that only people who are criminals are want to be anonymous online.
Ah,
it's the same level of stupidity.
Okay.
And it really bothers me that somebody in authority is actually saying that, because, you know, how long is it going to be before that starts to propagate to other people in authority, and now we all have to have these devices on us all the time, tracking us at every minute.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm always missing whether my phone is off or not, so I don't know if that's fair. I don't have a particular problem with being monitored. I expect that the government is watching me all the time anyway, wherever I am. I don't really think there's any expectation in the modern world of privacy anyway, so it doesn't bother me from that angle, like you're wanted or missing, as if it's nefarious. For you to not have your phone on. However, personally for me, if it's something that I want, like right now I want my phone for whatever's going on, like I get a tremendous amount of anxiety if it isn't on or can't be on.
Phone is off. I'm either wanted or missing. Okay. So this is obviously a logic puzzle. Just because we're here at the 2600 meeting, it's going to, okay, someone took that phone, they're doing something funny with it, but that's about where my mind goes.
So I'm also a bit of a privacy nerd. I do like to run Linux when I can, and also if I have to run Windows, run it in a virtual machine with GPU pass-through. I do think that the viewpoints that a lot of people have towards devices should gravitate a little towards being a little more open to people that want to keep their data private. I think people should be more concerned about their data because they don't realize just how much these apps are collecting information about them.
Honestly, my gut reaction is the same.
Mm.
Obviously, there are a ton of reasons to have your phone off.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you know a person and you know that they're typically responsive, you know that they don't turn their phone off for 8 hours at work, or you know that except when they're sleeping, they're going to be on their phone, even if they're not responding to you, you're going to see the received receipt.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I know my partner is awake at night. Is if I text him like a meme or something sweet or whatever, and I see that it's not delivered, I know his phone's off. So if you do know your person's habits, you know that their phone is typically on at this period of time. And in the year 2024, this is the case for most of the people you know. So many of us are like that now. That I agree, if somebody's phone is off during prime time for it to be on, I would pause. That would be a yellow flag.
Okay.
And yet, once I've paused, I can easily think, well, maybe they're taking a nap. Maybe they're shopping at that fucking Hannaford that doesn't have any goddamn reception inside the entire building. They don't. $100 device. People can have reception inside their building. But no. What was the original question? I agree. Like, I would, if I had a list of things I was building of how sus a situation was, somebody made a really ominous, threatening statement and then vanished, or a woman says that her boyfriend just punched her and now you can't find the boyfriend, his phone is off. You know, you're adding it on to other things. This person normally comes home at 3:00, now it's 6:00. This is a real break in their routine and their phone's off. I would worry.
Okay, I don't subscribe to this as a general rule, but in this instance, I have to say, fuck the police. We have a bedrock principle of innocent until proven guilty. And this seems to violate that. And also, to paraphrase Frank Zappa, this guy's enforcing the laws that haven't been passed yet. My understanding is we are free as the owners of those devices to turn them on and off at will. But ipso facto, you've got it off, therefore you're up to no good. That's horseshit. I'm sorry.
Well, my thoughts on it, your phone could be off for a variety of reasons. It could just be that your battery died, you know, you're probably like doing other stuff, and then you just, you know, you happen to forget to charge it along the way. I don't think it's suspicious at all. I feel like police, like, I'm not saying like for like all of like the departments are like, there are some bad eggs, but you know, like those bad eggs like shouldn't represent the entirety of like the police departments, because I'm pretty sure that there are cops out there that try to do their job honestly. It's just that there are some that just ruin it for like the whole force. But for that quote, it's not suspicious at all that your phone is off. It could be a variety of reasons. It's not suspicious at all.
2600 meetups are held on the first Friday of the month in various parts of the world, usually at 5 in the evening. The Albany group meets at the Starbucks in Stuyvesant Plaza at 6 p.m. There was a story that surfaced in the past couple of weeks that, thankfully, turned out to be false due to an error in translation, but it prompted a further question. The mistranslated story made it sound as though a fleet of so-called smart toothbrushes had been used to build a botnet that was being used as an attack platform to carry out a distributed denial-of-service attack. Okay, so that was false. But let me ask a simple question. What the actual fuck does a goddamn toothbrush need a motherfucking network connection for? A toothbrush's purpose is to remove tartar and debris from your teeth. No part of that task is aided with the addition of Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or any other manner of networking. If you want an electric toothbrush, that's another matter. Those are objectively better than a manual one. It does not, however, need to talk to anything to do that. Battery, switch, motor, done. And this is not the only thing that you do not need to connect to your network. Your cat's litter box, your stick of deodorant, your salt shaker, fragrance dispenser, toaster. None of these need to be connected to your network, and some of them don't even need power. These, by the way, are real things. Enough already. This view should be obvious from the interview earlier in this episode where Phil grilled me for a few minutes. That said, Sky Raider had a comment on this story, which is, and I quote, "If your toothbrush isn't networked, you're either missing or wanted." Nice callback, sir. In episode 140, I talked about Sony and content that people have bought to stream over their devices. Just as in that episode, when you hear me say the word bought in that tone, you should imagine me making air quotes, because I literally am standing here in my studio making air quotes when I say bought in this context. Back then, the problem was that Sony had sold consumers what appeared to be perpetual licenses to stream some content that they themselves hadn't in turn bought perpetual licenses to. Now, I'm sure that there is some fine print somewhere in the end user license agreement that liberates them from any responsibility for this situation, but it shouldn't take much of an imagination to realize that I don't think very highly of that. Anyway, apparently, Sony has bought Funimation. They will be shutting down Funimation in its current form on April 2nd of this year, and it currently appears that any content that you bought from Funimation will become inaccessible. It'll just go poof, and it is yours no more. Not that it ever was. I would like to be wrong about this. If I become aware that I am wrong about this, I will let you all know, and I will celebrate my error. The entertainment industry behaves as if this is the best that they can do due to their licensing deals. I don't buy it. So, when I see a purchase where I can't take possession of some kind of physical media or unencrypted file download, I don't buy it. So I was thinking that I might start a new section of the show, which I am calling Laws That Will Totally Work. It might not appear in every episode going forward, but I got a couple doozies here. On Thursday, the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, made a ruling banning the use of voice cloning technology in robocalls. The ruling was triggered by some election year fuckery, specifically that a pair of telemarketing firms in Texas had allegedly used the technology to make robocalls to New Hampshire in the run-up to the primary elections there. The robocalls had a digitally reproduced clone of President Biden's voice advising recipients not to cast a ballot in the primary. Now, while this does address a demonstrated problem, it's unlikely to work in the grand scheme of things. You see, voice over IP technology has made it disturbingly easy to have telemarketer robocalls come from outside of the country, out of the reach of the FCC. On top of that, Many such calls have been spoofing call ID information in various ways in the hopes of persuading the recipient to pick up the phone. If you can't stop that, how are you going to stop overseas scam artists from using AI to produce cloned voices that say whatever you want them to say? The other item I have here comes from our fine northern neighbor. It seems as though Canada has a significant car theft problem. I listen regularly to the news from the CBC, and I hear it quite frequently. So, that brings us to an interesting device called a Flipper Zero, which Wikipedia describes as, quote, a portable Tamagotchi-like multifunctional device developed for interaction with access control systems. The device is able to read, copy, and emulate RFID and NFC tags, radio remotes, iButton, and digital access keys, along with a GPIO interface, end quote. So, what the Canadian government seems poised to do is to ban these devices. In a tweet, or whatever the hell you call posts on X these days, Canadian MP François-Philippe Champagne stated, quote, criminals have been using sophisticated tools to steal cars, and Canadians are rightly worried. Today, I announced that we are banning the importation, sale, and use of consumer hacking devices like flippers used to commit these crimes. So the biggest problem I have is a simple question. What does this look like? So I know in particular what a Flipper Zero looks like. The Wikipedia article described it as Tamagotchi-like. So basically, it looks like a toy, and that's on purpose. But what of the next such tool? The electronics are so compact that they could be fit into all manner of different containments to look like anything the builder wants them to look like. Also, I must ask the gentleman from Saint-Marie-Champlain, are you also going to ban smartphones? Because those can be used as hacking devices. What about laptop computers? You gonna ban amateur radios? No, Monsieur Champagne, this is not going to work. It is too broad, and it will decrease the security of Canadian facilities by removing a useful tool from the hands of folks looking to secure your infrastructure. In other words, yeah, that law is totally gonna work. As usual, we'll end the show with the fail of the fortnight. Okay, this is interesting. Things get stolen. That's a fact. We've talked about it in this episode, Stolen Cars in Canada. We've seen money stolen by way of SIM swaps. But this is a whole new level of WTF. In Jasper, Alabama, somebody stole a fucking radio station. You heard that right. So apparently, Friday morning, the landscaping crew showed up to the tower site to do a spring clearing, and they found that the tower was gone, the door to the equipment shack was ajar, and some of the equipment, including the transmitter, was missing. That is a neat trick. The first thing I have to ask is, how did this go unnoticed? From what I have read about the radio station on its Wikipedia page, the station in question, WJLX, was prone to frequent breakdowns. So, nothing really appeared to be amiss from the perspective of the listeners, if indeed they had any. The station also streams on the internet. It also simulcasts on FM, so it's quite plausible that only a few listeners even noticed, and that those listeners had options to go elsewhere. On top of that, the station ran an oldies format, which, not to put too fine a point on it, might mostly, honestly, be filling a need that is better served with a Spotify playlist, especially if the station was, as I assume it is, automated. I do have to wonder how the station engineer didn't notice this, though. A station going off the air should sound an alarm. So having put that out there, let's talk about how this might have happened. The obvious hypothesis is that it was stolen for scrap by somebody that figured that it might not be missed. If the station broke down frequently, an unexpected shutdown would, well, be kind of expected, despite the name. Someone who knows this could have gone in, torn down the 200-foot tower, carted it off to the scrapyard. If you list the states of the Union in order by GDP, Alabama sits fairly near the middle of the list, so it isn't that the state is excessively poor, but poverty is a thing, and it could pose a motive, so that's one possibility. A second hypothesis that I have heard is that this could have been the work of disgruntled ex-employees. It might be worth noting that dismantling the tower would need to be done by somebody who understands how to work around high-powered radio transmitters without getting RF burns. They would have to know that they need to power off the transmitter before getting close to the tower. They would have to know where the disconnect is or figure it out, or at least ground the tower in order to do that before starting work on disassembling the tower. So, this has some merit. But let me throw a few more ideas on the table before I hit the third hypothesis. As I mentioned earlier, the station also streams and also has an FM translator. Now, historically, FM translators were licensed so that a radio station can fill in a gap in its coverage. Done as originally intended, this would be done by hooking up a transmitter to a radio tuned to the station it's translating, and literally just retransmit the AM signal onto FM. However, in some cases, the translator can be connected directly to the studio and still be licensed as a translator, which for an AM station could mean better sound quality on their FM frequency. I've noticed this with a few stations in my area, for instance. Did I mention that the station's branding identifies it as 101.5 FM rather than 1240 AM? Yeah, their website is wjlx1015.com. So, that leads us to the next piece, which is that they petitioned the FCC for temporary authority to operate only their FM transmitter in light of the AM one having gone missing. This was denied, because of course it would set a bad precedent. You see where this goes? This kind of leads us to that third possibility, that third hypothesis. And I kind of suspect this one, which is that the station management disappeared the equipment as a gamble to turn their AM station with an FM translator into an FM station. Let's see. Boring format. Format not well suited to low fidelity. Big awkward assets needed to operate. Kinda tracks. Now, I'm not making an accusation here, but I can totally see how this might have unfolded in several different ways. I do have to say, though, that it's very suspicious that a 200-foot broadcast tower could disappear and it wasn't noticed until the landscapers showed up to mow. I see a failing radio station that nobody much cares about suffering from neglect from its management, and I really can't help but wonder if this was an inside job. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the Crowded Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Fungaboo, Thriller at Play, Mickey Metz, Ed Asriel, Joe Cadillac, Alex Marthews, Knight Rider 007, DOA, and Sky Raider for story leads, and to Phil, Finnegan, Tim the Enchanter, Denzuko, Philip, The Axe That Slayed Me, Sky Raider, and Michael for appearing in this episode. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 144 will drop on the 24th of February. Stay safe and be well.